welcome back to the Product People Show. All you folks who are still subscribed to this feed, thank you. These are the true fans, the people that keep subscribed no matter how many shows are coming through. And today I have a surprise for you, a great conversation with Tom and Dan from Studio Neat. If you have ever wanted to make your own physical products, or you've thought about, you know, it'd be cool if I could have like a boutique and make numerous different products for different audiences, this interview is all about that. Before we get to that, today is February 9th, 2016, and tomorrow, February 10th, I'm launching Marketing for Product People. Now, those of you that have been around for a while know that I released a book in October called Marketing for Developers. It did really well, but a lot of people saw that and said, you know, I would really like that same information. So they asked me to rewrite it for non-engineers, and that is what I did. You can get yourself a copy at justinjackson.ca/marketingforproductpeople. There's also a free chapter there with a really good tip on getting more leads through Twitter using Twitter cards. So go check that out, justinjackson.ca/marketingforproductpeople. All right, let's get into the show. You can't keep all the friendly stuff for before you hit record.
Yeah, no, it's true. That's something I think we're learning is in our podcast to just start record, like start the show right away and leave some of the banter in.
Some people love the banter, and some people hate it.
I think it's good.
That's what Nerdist does, where they just like don't even tell the guest they're recording.
Yeah.
It seems to work well.
And then they finish the whole interview and they wonder why the other guy hung up on them. Wait, what? All right, guys. Well, let's get into it. You guys want to jump right in?
Sure.
Do we need a how's your neighbor? How's the kid?
Good. He's good. He's walking around now. So, you know, that's a whole new world. Kind of. He's like 11 and a half months. So he's, you know.
Oh, yeah. And you're still working from home?
Yeah.
Oh, as soon as they start walking, that's when you got to get out of there, man.
Well, he, you know, I have a closed door and...
You have a closed door policy.
Yeah, so I have a closed door policy. Soon I will like install one of those red lights, like a recording studio light, or it's like you cannot enter when this red light's on.
That's always good for kids when they're explaining to their friends at school what goes on. When dad's got the red light on, I'm not allowed to go in his room.
Yeah, not weird or creepy at all.
And how about you, Dan? How's things going over there?
Good.
How much hockey are you playing these days?
Zero. Same as before, which is zero.
I was in
Minnesota for Christmas, and I was near a lake, but it wasn't frozen sufficiently enough to wander on it, yeah.
I know I'm the only person that likes that joke, but I just can't get over it.
I like it. You're the first person who ever thought that or said that about me or my name. So.
But has there been anyone else? I think I'm the only one, aren't I?
Yeah, the first and only.
Wait, is Dan Provost a Canadian hockey player or just a hockey player?
To me, Provost just sounds like a hockey name, but I think there is a Provost. I think there was a Provost. Let's see, Provost NHL. Claude Joseph Antoine Provost.
Yeah, Provost has like French Canadian roots somewhere along the line.
Here, I'm going to show you, Tom, you never knew this, but I'm going to show you Dan's great grandpa, this guy right here. Here, let's see if I can zoom in on this guy. Oh, this is they could only afford the 220 pixel wide version, but Claude Provost, good old Grandpa Claude.
It kind of looks like Dan. That could be part of his mythology.
Well,
we don't know.
I mean, he's clearly not American with a last name like that. So
yeah.
All right.
Definitely not.
This is how I'd like to start this interview. I was actually thinking about this the other day. I was thinking about the first time I met Dan when I made that joke. And I asked Dan, as you do, what do you do? And do you remember what you said, Dan?
No, I don't.
You, I mean, we were drunk at the time. But you said, well, I make... This is a, this is this was the pause you did. You said, "Well, I make things," and that was basically it.
Yeah.
And so,
all right.
Maybe to like give people an idea of what you guys do, because you guys are two guys. They don't know how you guys are. You know, what do you guys work together? What do you guys do?
We make things.
Case closed.
Thanks for joining us today, guys. And you guys started a company called Studio Neat.
Yeah, yes. Yeah. So we started out 5 years ago with a Kickstarter project for a little tripod mount for the iPhone 4. So that was the first thing that we made. And that was just totally a side project. Like, we were both working full-time as basically software designers, and then had this idea for a product and put it on Kickstarter, and you know, kind of the rest is history. It blew up and kind of forced us to think about starting a company and doing it full time, which are two things we did, you know, shortly after the Kickstarter project. And then we've just been making stuff, both physical and software, ever since.
And so you guys had never made anything like a physical product before.
Not at the mass scale, no. Like, both Dan and I, because of like our schooling background and just general interest, we like made a lot of things, used our hands and knew our way around that. But yeah, definitely nothing like that was sold, and like we dealt with manufacturers and stuff like that. Nothing like that.
Yeah, and so that was that the Glyph? Was that the first one?
Yeah. The Glyph. Yeah. So the Glyph, and yeah, we since then we've made all kinds of things. We've done several pieces of, we've done like a capacitive stylus, some like cocktail accessories, other like iOS type accessories. We'll probably will do some electronic stuff in the future. So a pretty wide berth. We are a little bit strange in that we haven't picked a genre or like a product line really. We kind of go super horizontal. Like, if you go to our website, there's like iPhone accessories next to like cocktail stuff, next to, you know, this and that.
Yeah.
Next to book stuff. And so not the smartest way to do things, certainly, but it's just fun. Like, basically, we just, when we decide to make something, it's because it's like a need we have in our life. We're like, man, you know, I wish this existed, or I wish this thing was like this. And so we, you know, if we think that other people, you know, agree, and that there's a market there and the pricing fits and all this stuff works, then we'll just make it. And so it kind of makes a strange brand, but it's really fun for us.
Yeah. Now let's talk about that actually while we're on the, because you brought it up, because I've been writing about that quite a bit. Do you think it's not the smartest way to do it, to have a variety like that instead of just focusing on one thing?
It's safe in that, like, if you look at our revenue, there's no thing we sell that's bigger than like a third of our company. So it's not like we have this one product and everything depends on the one product. So in some ways, that diversification is really nice. Where it's a downside is, you know, for instance, the Glyph. We could have taken the Glyph and made Glyph Co., like Glyph Inc.,
yeah,
and had a company that's just about the Glyph and all about camera accessories, and just built out a line. And what happens is your customers know that's what you're known for, and they can come back for different stuff, and you can like sell them the new versions and all this stuff. And it's just like a really easy way to kind of compartmentalize stuff.
Yeah.
But we, you know, we don't do that. So like, say we have a mailing list, you know, of like a bunch of people on it who were there because of the Glyph and what we made before with like Apple related stuff. Now we have cocktail stuff, and it's like,
yeah,
you guys want this too, you know? So so that's what's kind of strange.
And I think, have they? How much overlap is there? Like, how many repeat customers do you have going from genre to genre?
It totally kind of depends. Like, with the cocktail stuff, I think that had a pretty decent, you know, kind of Venn diagram overlap. I think that they're pretty similar kind of demographics of who are interested in those types of things, generally speaking. But there's been other things we've tried where that's not been the case. You know, we tried to make this pet toy thing last year, which didn't work out. And so I think that was an example of the downside of what Tom was saying, where it's like, you're essentially starting from scratch more or less with a new audience that is not, you know, existing that you already have. And so there's definitely a downside to that if it doesn't work.
Yeah. So on the pro side, you've said you felt like these are things that you personally are passionate about, so it makes it easy to want to develop them. But the downside is there's not necessarily, you can't necessarily go back to those same customers each, you know, time after time and say, you know, here's something new.
Yeah, and it gets even more crazy, like even just press contacts or just knowing the space. Or like when we tried to release a pet toy on Kickstarter, like we didn't have press contacts like in the like pet world, right? And so it's literally almost starting from scratch, right? So and the other big thing, which is kind of a big deal, is just supply chain. So when you're making a physical product, you know, we have a really, if we were to make versions of the glyph, we have everything set up for that. So it's very easy actually to make a new version of a glyph. But for instance, we're working on two new products right now. One of them is a soft good. So it's the first time we've done anything with like real fabric or like a technical like fabric thing.
Yeah.
And so A, we don't know the manufacturing language. We don't have any manufacturing partners. We don't have any of that stuff. And so we're kind of building a supply chain from scratch with every new product sometimes.
Yeah.
And that takes a lot of time, and it's one of the hardest things to do. So that's another big piece, is just like those infrastructural issues are really easy when you're just kind of tweaking something, but when you're doing a whole new thing, it's rough.
Yeah.
But I guess if we do that enough times, we'll eventually exhaust all of the like manufacturing methods, and then we'll just be set. We can make anything.
Is that something you guys debate like between you guys? Is like, man, Dan, we gotta niche down. We gotta focus on one thing.
It's not really a debate. It's always kind of a conversation, though. It's like something we're always kind of questioning and thinking about. But in general, we've been the same. We stayed the same as we've always been, which is just like letting product ideas that excite us kind of guide what we work on. But I think definitely recently we're trying to be a little bit smarter about, you know, serving our existing audience and things like that. But we've been pretty consistent in just like, you know, following the excitement of our ideas.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you feel like the funny thing is that like the other kind of, I'm sure you're going to hate this, but the other people I think about all the time that seem similar to you is the guys that need want. Is that what they're called?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Are those guys like your mortal enemies?
No. We have kind of met them, and we're kind of doing a little thing with them. They are very similar. One of the main differences, I think, between us and them in terms of the way they structure their brands is, you know, Need Want is like an umbrella corporation kind of, right, or a parent corporation. And then they'll have like Peel or something, which is a sub-brand.
Yeah.
And there's not, you know, when they have a different kind of product line, they like have brands for them.
Yeah.
And we have decided to make it more flat and horizontal, where you come to Studio Neat and we have all this different stuff.
That's right.
I think we're starting to run into a problem where we're going to have more and more stuff, and so we need to kind of silo and have segments. You know, like say with, like for instance, the email list is a really good example. Like it'd be nice to have an email list that's just cocktail folks, so that we can talk to them and make content about specific nerdy cocktail stuff, and I have to talk to the glyph people about that.
Yeah, yeah.
So we're thinking about ways we can kind of dice that up, but we still want, we think, Studio Neat to be there. So the main way we kind of approach product branding in that way is the glyph by Studio Neat or the Cosmonaut. And so the name of the product is pretty strongly branded and sometimes has a logo.
Yeah.
But it's like still by Studio Neat always. So that's a main difference. But beyond that, yeah, it feels pretty kindred spirits, those guys.
Yeah, because they're doing a bunch of different things. You just need to segment your list. You got cat ladies, alcoholics.
And like photo nerds. Yeah, we're good. All you need.
Nobody sees those segments. It's okay. You can name them whatever you want. Now, I want to talk about going pro, because you guys released that first thing and it went nuts on Kickstarter.
Yep.
What the heck? Was there just like an apparition in front of my face?
I think that was like a piece of fuzz or something.
It's a good thing that didn't catch on fire with these like lights I got going. You guys went pro really quick with the glyph. And was that primarily because of the Gruber effect? Is that really what happened?
Totally. Yeah, it was. I mean, basically, he linked it kind of within the first 24 hours of us launching it, and it was just, you know, like a total hockey stick thing. And then, you know, Gizmodo and all these others, you know, found it as a result of the Gruber post. So, yeah, I would see that was definitely the catalyst.
So what was that like? Because there's some people that, like, work for a long time. And actually, even those guys at NeedWant are interesting because they started with, you know, little products and they kind of kept notching themselves up. And you guys were kind of on a, what do we call, a speed train right away.
Yeah, no, we went 0 to 60. It was insane. I mean, I don't think we've ever had a good of a year revenue-wise as, like, our first full year. So it was really, like, really big, really fast. But it's funny because Dan and I stayed with our full-time jobs working 4 days a week like 6 months. So we had, like, shipped the Glyph. It was all done. And then we had another – the next idea was a Cosmonaut. We launched that as a Kickstarter. And then I think as soon as we saw that that kind of took off, then we're like, okay, we know we're going to need the time to really devote to selling the Glyph and developing the Cosmonauts. So that's when we decided to both quit our job. So we were really conservative because, like, we had a good business, like, immediately with the Glyph, but we just didn't. The thing I remember is this was 2010 when we were the first big Kickstarter for a product ever.
Yeah.
And so it wasn't like, it felt like a fluke. Like, it was like, is this, we weren't sure, like, is this just like fake and like a fluke?
Yeah.
But then when it happened again, we're like, okay, there's like, this can happen, right? So it just convinced us that, you know, there's a future in it and we should keep going.
Yeah. And, but do you think, like, the second one, were there a lot of people that followed you to that second, to the Cosmonaut?
I think so. Yeah. And we didn't even, we definitely got some good press for that, but, like, I don't think Gruber linked to it the second time around. And so that was another thing that was really encouraging is, like, okay, we've actually built a little bit of an audience here to where we don't have to have Gruber link every one of our products for them to, you know, succeed.
Yeah.
So that was encouraging.
Yeah. And what made you, like, want to keep, what was it about that? Because that must have also been insane to figure out. Everyone I talked to that's been in your boat to figure out fulfillment and to figure out all that stuff, which I'm sure was a nightmare while you were working at the same time. What was it about it that made you want to keep going?
We got tricked.
That was a synchronized sigh.
Yeah. Well,
you know what I say about sighs? Is it a sigh is like a meditation for really busy people? And then
we got tricked. The Glyph was very easy, and it had no hiccups. It got manufactured and shipped out in 3 months, which is unheard of and crazy. And so next time around, we're like, this stuff is easy. Like, it just all came together. And, you know, we've, you know, subsequently learned that that is not the case. But yeah, there was no big problems at all. So it was really easy to just be like, let's do that again.
Yeah,
but also, and the, you know, the reason that we've, like, continued doing it and doing products is that nothing really beats the rush of, like, putting a new product out there, whether it's Kickstarter or just, like, our own thing or releasing an app or whatever. I think it's just, like, a very addictive feeling that we just keep chasing over and over again.
Yeah, well, actually, let's talk about that piece because, in some ways, in my own life, I'm moving into that too of, you know, last year I made a bunch of money consulting and it was basically just focused on one thing. And then on the side, I always had side projects. But now that I stopped consulting in November, that feeling of, like, wow, I got to do this, like, over and over and over again. You guys must also feel, on the other hand, of, like, wow, maybe we should just become Glyph Co. and just, like, you know, make a billion glyphs and, you know, just start shipping them out. So what do you guys have stress around product launches? Do you also stress about, like, if we have no good ideas next year? Maybe take me through some of that.
Definitely. We definitely stress out about product launches. I mean, we don't release something until we feel good about it. So the fear, like, say with Obi, like, Obi was our first kind of big failure. This just this last summer, and I think where we we came away from it saying, we designed the product we wanted to exist. We did a good job there, but it just didn't have the market, or we didn't have a big enough megaphone to tell the right people or whatever. So we always feel pretty good about the product, and then, you know, if something is not what we quite think, it's just, it usually comes up to like market fit or something. Mm-hmm. But yeah, no, we stress out. I mean, we definitely stress out about it, and there's definitely the, you know, like, we don't know what we're going to be doing in 6 months, basically. Mm-hmm. We have a little bit of a roadmap. We have some products we're developing now that we're hopefully going to get out soon. So it really is like we're reliant on these new ideas, and that's kind of how our business is structured. But, you know, there's a lot of stuff out. I think the faith we have is that there's a ton of stuff out there, and there's a ton of people out there. And so if we, you know, can find the things that feel right, there's going to be other people there too. And really, it's funny because our strategy kind of previous to this year was, let's wait around till there's a really big idea that's good, unique, maybe doesn't exist, and we can make a really big dent. Mm-hmm. But this year we're going to try a little bit different approach and make smaller things and more of them and just see what happens there and kind of more rely on just kind of a routine of products. And, you know, of course, if there's a big thing that comes in, we're going to do it, but filling the gap with smaller things that might not have to be a huge hit, right? And so mm-hmm. We'll see how that goes. It might turn up to be just like there's so much noise and there's so much crap going on that we don't get those really good big ideas. But I think we are just kind of tired of saying no to so many ideas, not because they're good products, but because like someone's already doing it or whatever. So we'll see. It's kind of an experiment for us, but we'll see.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. As you were talking, there's actually a couple things I wanted kind of touch on here. The one thing I think about, there's like two different kinds of movie makers. There's like, now I got to think of the folks. Like there's Peter Jackson who puts out like one big thing and, you know, they have to be really huge. And then there's, how come I can't think of his name, the guy that makes a movie every 12 months in New York.
Woody Allen.
Woody Allen just makes films as a career. Every 12 months he's going to come out with another one. And some are do better than others, but they're basic and they follow kind of the same thing. But it's like he's got this routine with making things. You know, he just knows he's going to go to work every day and make this year's film. So that, it's kind of it's kind of similar, parallels what you're talking about, that you guys are thinking about trying to just go to work every day and make smaller things and release those.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, for us, it was really, and we've said this a couple of times recently, it's really a 1-2 punch between something we spent 7 months on, Obi, failing, mm-hmm. and then right after that, we released this little wooden stand for the new Apple TV remote.
Yeah.
Simplest product. It took us not even like 2 weeks of design. I mean, it was very simple, very small supply chain. We made it in-house, actually, so it was very little, but it did really well. It got a ton of press. We've sold a lot of them. So that for us was like, okay, like, you know, that showed us that maybe there's something different that we can do, right?
Yeah.
In a real clear way.
Yeah. Now, the other thing that kind of inspired me after I hung out with you guys for the first time was I started my career in physical manufacturing, building skateboards and snowboards. And that supply chain, there was very few people doing it on a small scale. Like you couldn't be just a guy on the street and say, I want to start a snowboard company.
Yeah.
And then I met you guys and you're basically two guys in Texas that are building physical things. And this is, it kind of like opened my mind to that whole world that this is now possible for very, very small companies or even individuals to make physical things. Maybe talk to me a bit about that. Like what, you guys have done software too, but you're clearly passionate about physical stuff.
Yeah, I think it's just a kind of colliding of all these different like services and opportunities that didn't exist, you know, 5 or 10 years ago. So if you look at kind of the line, the path of what it takes to make a physical product, like, you know, the funding aspect, we have Kickstarter now or things similar to that. And then So the prototyping is now new with, you know, 3D printers and affordable CNC things, and or even just like mailing away to get prototypes, you know, made for you. That's fairly new. And then the manufacturing processes have more or less been around for a while, but there's new ways of finding them and reaching out to them and communicating with them.
Yeah.
And then, you know, the selling of the product, you know, we have Shopify and all these internet online things, and you can send it to Amazon. And then, you know, the fulfillment aspect, there's now services for that too. So I feel like all this stuff is like within the last 10 years, maybe even 5 years, didn't exist.
Yeah.
And so it's like kind of just like the perfect timing of all these things coming together to where, yeah, it's like me and Tom are the only two employees, and we've stayed that way from the beginning. It's because we can kind of outsource all these aspects of the, you know, the chain.
And that's exciting, but it must also be like, especially now, it was probably really fun at the beginning, but now there's a lot of people getting into this, like a lot of people kind of trying to do your thing. Do you notice more collisions now? Is it like you talk to a manufacturer in China and they're like, oh, I'm sick and tired talking to you Kickstarter guys, or like, have you noticed anything like that yet?
Let me think of it. Yeah, I mean, the funny thing is, it's mostly been good. Where it used to be, when I called cold called a manufacturer, they were just confused and they're like, wait, where are you getting this money? And I would say like Kickstarter, and they're like, what? You know? Yeah. And so in some ways it's been easier because it's like they understand, you know, there's like more likely that they've like heard of, you know, something like that. But on the other hand, there's just way more noise now, right? Where it used to be, it was like a news story that we were making a stylus and where it was like on Kickstarter, but now that's like not the case at all, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, there's definitely a give and take there, but definitely we're all for more people coming in and more services being developed, because all of our pain points as a company, most of them, we feel like they can be solved with a service. And so when more and more people come, there's going to be more of those services built up, because we want to stay a two-person shop. We want to stay really small.
Yeah.
And the things that are going to make us hire employees is like customer service or shipping stuff or weird things like that, and we just want that to be outsourced as much as we can. So
yeah,
we're all for this kind of field growing for sure.
That's an interesting point, because then if there's more people like you, then there's more things like what's the Cards Against Humanity warehousing
service? Black box.
Yeah, black box. So now there's a market opportunity for them to say, we will help serve you guys, and that takes a huge amount of work off your shoulders and less risk too.
Yeah, definitely. And for us, it's just about overhead, right? So one of the big reasons why we like to stay small is, A, it's really just simple. The business is very simple. We can make decisions super fast because we're two people.
Mm-hmm.
But there's no overhead. Like, we both like working from our home office, so we can take risks with maybe a product that's really small and niche, because we don't have to sell 30,000 of them for it to be worth it for us to develop, right?
Yeah.
So we love that freedom and being able to kind of move around and try different stuff. And so one of our fears with kind of growing in a employee type of way is there's going to be more constraints on needing revenue. And so we just have to make different decisions possibly, right, about what we do, or take less risks. So that's kind of where the inflection point is.
Yeah, yeah, I get it. Because right now, as a two-person company, you can keep making things without worrying that like this has got to cover Janice's paycheck. I just invented Janice. I'm not saying.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. We have no Janice. But yeah, no. That's exactly right. That fear is not there. So it's good.
And a guy at the co-working office found these for me, and I ordered two right away. And what it is it's a 3D printed kind of clasp.
Oh.
That sticks, mm-hmm. like it has adhesive on the bottom, and I didn't even cut the ties. It just wraps up, and then it keeps your frayed cord from fraying more. And this is, I love this idea that this guy's just 3D printing these and shipping them out. And you guys have started doing this now too with the stand. And did you do another one that was?
Yeah, there's something pretty similar to that. That was like a little clip for the Apple Watch charger, where it's basically, if you wanted to more securely fasten the clip, because it's only a magnetic connection, so, and it's a pretty weak magnetic connection, so if you wanted to connect it, if you're, for example, like throwing it in your bag and charging your watch with an external battery pack or something, it's just a 3D printed piece of plastic that allows it to kind of clip onto the watch in a more secure way than just the magnet.
So is that the future for you guys? Are you going to try to do more stuff in-house?
I mean,
possibly.
Yeah, maybe, but like, I mean, that was just like a fun little thing. It's like, hey, this is a blog post. That's like about as seriously as we took it.
Yeah.
And I think the main reason for that is there's still a huge gulf in the materiality of 3D printed stuff. Yeah. So, you know, it's rare that you can develop a product that the 3D printing is like the right process for it, but that's really going to change really quick. And so, you know, like shapeways.com is a website where that's all it is. It's like basically e-commerce store where designers put up their designs and then someone comes and buys it, and all just Shapeways just like prints it, sends it to them, and then gives a cut to the designer. And so soon as the materials get a little bit better for 3D printing and the process gets a little bit cheaper, it's going to be huge, huge, huge like shift in the way that especially little simple objects are made, because you'll just have a 3D printer at home and you'll just like buy it, or it will be free probably a lot of the time.
Yeah.
Just the design, and you'll just come in and you just buy that and it's no problem. And so that's coming. And you know, I think about that sometimes, like, what's that gonna mean? But I think there's still always gonna be a huge difference between just like materiality and things. But definitely, but like for up and coming young designers, like if I was in like starting high school right now and I wanted to be a product designer,
yeah,
like in 10 years, this is gonna be the reality of like what I'm talking about. And it's gonna be, I would just be starting to sell stuff, print stuff like now, you know? I mean, it's a huge change.
And I wonder if there will be more like centralized. I mean, right now everything is in China and they've got the advantage of that whole supply chain thing there. But if there is, you know, if there's a place, where does everyone ship out of, like, whatever it is, Illinois, or I don't know where people ship centrally.
South Dakota a lot of the time.
Okay. So like if they, you know, if there's like a place there that's that has just like CNC machines on tap, and you can order stuff and have it like just go through their process, they build it and ship it from there, like Shapeways, I guess. But the designer is, you know, in Canada. That stuff gets me really excited, because for me, all the pain with physical stuff is actually the warehousing of it and the shipping of it. So if you could have it like in built on demand and shipped from somewhere, that seems amazing. One thing I think, I mean, we just touched on this a little bit, is like, what would you recommend to somebody who's getting started?
You can read our book, I guess, to start.
What's the book called?
It's called It Will Be Exhilarating.
And you take them through the process of kickstarting, stuff like that?
More or less, yeah. It's basically, we wrote it, I don't know, 2 or 3 years ago when we had like 2 or 3 products in the marketplace. And yeah, it was basically just like, you know, showing our work, showing what we did to do what we did. So, you know, there's some stuff about Kickstarter in there. There's stuff about all the kind of prototyping and design and manufacturing of physical goods and shipping them and all that. And then there's like a little bit of marketing type stuff in there. So, I mean, it's like slightly outdated in terms of just like where we're at as a company, but I think most of it is still relevant. And that's kind of why we wrote it, is for exactly what you're describing, as someone who's like wanting to be inspired or get started doing these type of things.
Yeah. Is there a scope of project or a kind of project that you think is good for people to start with?
You know, what I always, whenever I talk to people who are starting out, one thing that I think people should try is maybe not the like handmade Etsy thing where you're doing everything yourself. It's very manual. You're doing everything yourself, because you're not really learning all the stuff that will take you to like this being a business, because this whole world of like working with the manufacturer to have parts made, or like outsourcing, or like warehousing, all those things are the actual problems. And so I think it's actually not that hard to dip your toe into that in a simple way. But I think it's really important to do that, because then it becomes, doesn't become this big scary monster. Because really, it's not hard. It just seems scary. And people always ask me, like, how do you guys find, like, how to do sewing? This is how it works. I look on Google for, like, injection molding plastic, and I call up the company, and I'm like, hey, we're thinking about doing this. Like, how does it work? What are the constraints? And they'll just, like, tell you a lot of the time. So yeah, it's not that big scary thing, but I think it's really important to start interfacing with manufacturing, or, like, the external, like, machine of kind of industry some, just so it doesn't become, like, a big scary thing.
And when you call China...
We don't call China. So that's the thing. We don't call, and for a lot of our history, we had nothing made in China.
Okay.
A lot of it was made in the U.S.
So you're just calling U.S. manufacturers.
Exactly. Yeah. And the real reason we're doing that is because we need that knowledge, right? So when we started out the Glyph, our manufacturing was in South Dakota. They understood where we were coming from, and the engineer really helped us out, like, understand the process. And so that's really great, and people will do that. And so that's why it's, you know, that's what's really nice about kind of local or, like, you know, domestic manufacturing, is you can, like, talk to the people really easily. And so that's a huge advantage if you're starting out. Yeah, it costs more, but it's totally worth it.
Oh, that's interesting, because I just assumed you were making things overseas, but you haven't made as much overseas.
Yeah, only a couple things, just only last year and a half probably. And it's a pain. It's a total pain. Still, it's a real pain.
Even though you understand some of the manufacturing process, like, what is it? If you call a factory in China, and, like, when you've done that, is there someone that speaks English there? Like, how does it work?
It's email almost always, or really Skype.
Yeah.
Almost always, everything's done via Skype. We recently been working with kind of a middleman, like a company in China. He's actually a Canadian guy.
Okay.
And he has a company in China, and we talk to him, and then he finds the factories and works with them. And so that can work out really well. But in some of the time, we've worked directly with a manufacturer in China, and it's, you know, it's hard. The communication is super hard, and the expectations of quality and design are completely different just culturally. And so the communication is just really rough. And so that is, I would not recommend that at all for anyone starting out. Definitely the localer, the better, because you could learn from the people making your thing, because they're the people who know the most about what you're doing.
Oh, that's interesting. That's probably a good place to end it. Let's peep your stuff. Let's pimp your stuff a little bit. what's Studio Neat working on next, and where can people find out about it?
Well, we're working on a couple things we're actually really excited about that we won't reveal just yet, but we're hoping to, you know, unveil
men's
and
underwear.
Launch them. Yeah. Candies. within the next couple months. So we're excited about that. So yeah, I mean, studioneat.com and at studioneat on Twitter is a good place to follow us. And then we also have a Gazette, which is just a weekly newsletter. If you go to, I think it's just studioneat.com/gazette should work. And you can sign up for that. And that, you know, it's really simple. Every Friday we just send a super short email, just a couple things Tom and I are kind of interested in that week, and then a very brief update of kind of what we're working on. So if you want to follow us in a really kind of simple but direct way, that's a good thing to look at too.
Sweet. I've also been really liking your Vimeo channel.
Yeah.
If you search Studio Neat on Vimeo, there's, like, some cool stuff there. I just like watching some stuff get made. And even if it's, like, you know, you've got some pretty slick videos on there, but you also have some real raw, just, like, gritty, like, here's how we did it. And, mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's good, too. Beauty.
Yeah.
Well, thanks,
great.
Guys. Thanks for your time. We'll talk again soon.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, thanks, man. See ya.
All right, that's it. Thanks again to Tom and Dan for doing the show, studioneat.com. Please, if you are a product person looking to launch a new product and just launching scares the hell out of you, you don't want to launch to crickets, go and check out Marketing for Product People, justinjackson.ca/marketingforproductpeople. Also, I forgot to tell you guys, I have a brand new show called Mega Maker. It's 10 minutes long. 2 episodes a week, and it's getting to the top of the iTunes charts right now. I would love for you to go and check it out, megamaker.co. And if you could leave a review and help me get into the top of New and Noteworthy, that would even be better. megamaker.co/review. Thank you for all you longtime listeners. I really appreciate you just enjoying the shows and telling people about them. All right. I will talk to you soon. If you have any questions, get me on Twitter, the letter M, the letter I, Justin. That's M-I Justin.